be good if you told me what to play, Anthony. Real good if you'd tell me what music you'd like to hear.
Play anything.
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man.
A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind.
A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination.
You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Next stop.
Your next stop.
It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone. The Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone.
Out of 15 episodes.
Damn, that's right, huh?
16.
Now that I think about it, 16 episodes.
Is this 16?
Is this number 16? 15, 14. Yep, that's number 16. Shit.
Fuck yes.
Dude.
All right, I guess now is as good a time as any to get started.
Y'all ready? Yes.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. And as always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Mr. Anthony Fuentes.
Hello, everyone. I'm a little sick today, but... You know how this usually goes.
So. Yeah, because he normally feels like shit the day after he goes out.
Yeah, that and every time I do a history episode, I think I just work myself into exhaustion and get sick immediately before that.
He went to sleep at like 10:30 last night.
Yeah, no, it was a... I did, huh?
You went to sleep super fucking early.
And I woke up late and still, whatever. I got DayQuil. We're good.
Get your shit together.
We're good.
So, we've alluded to it. We're very excited. Anthony has been abuzz with excitement and has been texting me about this particular episode for weeks.
Yeah, weeks.
He has been doing so much research on this. I aspire to be like him. What film are we talking about today, Anthony?
We're talking about Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yes. Not to be confused with the Hollywood Horror or Hotel, whatever, that movie. Because that's a movie that I have seen before, and I thought that's what it was.
Oh, no, this is way different.
Yeah, and then I realized I was sorely mistaken.
And not to be confused with Twilight, which fucking sucks and we'll never cover it.
Oh, my gosh.
I know, no, dogging on Twilight, it's 4 years too late, but you know what, you get
it. 4 years too late?
Is it four?
Try it four? Like 10 years too late.
Oh, see, I'm just cutting myself on this edge over here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chill.
I know.
So, if you have not seen the movie, pause the podcast right now, go watch it.
Yes.
Welcome back.
All right, cool, you guys are all back. Interesting stuff here. Now, as a precursor, guys, what we're going to be getting into is a case... and the production of this that coincide with each other, you're going to hear some pretty messed up stuff. So if, just so you know, maybe graphic content advisory warning later on in the cast. But we're also going to discuss the film. It's just, this is a very interesting history. Like I said last week, sometimes we do the history episodes and it's like, yay, all this mess turned into this successful franchise. This is the opposite, a successful franchise turning in on itself.
And so imploding because of a horrible, horrible tragedy.
Yes. So interesting.
Once we get to it, we will obviously give you guys a heads up, but just so you know.
Yes.
So for those of you who don't know, the synopsis
heads
is...
Heads up, really?
Oh, no.
No,
Oh, no.
Wow.
I made a mistake.
Wow.
I made a horrible mistake. I'm sorry. Anyway,
last messed up joke of the thing.
Four horror and science fiction segments directed by four famous directors, each of them being a new version of a classic story from Rod Serling's landmark television series, The Twilight Zone.
Yep, that's the synopsis, y'all. And this one was cool because it's the first one. It's the prologue starring Dan Aykroyd in there. Fucking awesome. And the first segment called Time Out was directed by John Landis, which we'll be spending most of the podcast talking about. Steven Spielberg did Kick the Can, and there's a very interesting reason why he did that particular one compared to his other options we'll go through. Joe Dante of Gremlins fame actually ended up doing It's a Good Life, and I feel like you can kind of see some of the style in
Definitely, sure.
And George Miller of Mad fucking Max fame, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, one of the most iconic episodes in any TV show.
And what I love about this is, like, you got two amazing actors who did, like, so for in Nightmare of 20,000 Feet, of course, we have William Shatner.
Yes.
And then in this version, we have freaking John Lithgow.
Yeah, so, I fucking love John Lithgow.
Yeah, me too. So it was really, really cool that, you know, you got to see, like, that comparison. Because everyone has seen A Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
Mm-hmm. And if you haven't, you've definitely seen the Simpsons version of this fucking skit.
Or you know, pop culture references to it. Mm-hmm. It is, because everyone got a fear of flying after this fucking episode.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and then also you have a Simpsons version of It's a Good Life. You know, both Bart-centric episodes, which is interesting. but yeah, this one is starring Dan Aykroyd, Albert Brooks, Scatman Crothers. I don't know who the guy is. Yeah, Scatman.
That's what, that is a great name.
What happened to this fucking guy? The aforementioned John Lithgow, Vic Morrow, and Kathleen Quinlan. Now, Vic Morrow's going to be a very big part of this podcast, and for obvious reasons. The budget was pretty cheap, actually. Only $10 million, which the directors had worked with a lot more prior to this. It was released on June 26, 1983. That was the wide release. And it only grossed about $29 million.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. I mean, I think it actually is total. But there's a good reason why it grossed again. So little. So, to understand this film, you're going to have to understand a little bit about The Twilight Zone, to which Miss Alex Webster is going to tell us about Rod Sterling's classic motherfucking TV show that I still watch to this day. Still watch it all the goddamn time.
So, you've heard us talk a little bit about The Twilight Zone in the past. I believe in our Child's Play episode.
Yes, Child's Play, for sure.
Because we talk about the Talking Tina episode. So you know our stance on The Twilight Zone. We both adore The Twilight Zone and grew up with The Twilight Zone. So it's a really cool thing to be able to talk about it for the podcast at length.
It's crazy. We grew up with it 2 generations away from its freaking premiere.
Mm-hmm.
2 generations.
Oh, yeah.
That's insane. Yeah, that's the lasting power of this fucking show.
Totally. And plus with the pending reboot by
Jordan Peele.
So it's gonna be cool.
I hope so. I mean, if you listen to this like a year later, please let us know if it's good.
But no, you know, I love Jordan Peele and I love The Twilight Zone, so I'm excited to see what he does. But anyway, enough about the future. Let's travel back to the past, shall we?
Which is a common theme in Twilight Zone episodes.
Yes. The Twilight Zone is an anthology series that tells short stories in the realm of fantasy, horror, science fiction, westerns, and more. It was created by Rod Sterling. Many of the episodes finish with a twist and often tackle heavy topical themes regarding technology, social justice, human behavior, and more.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that's a very astute
description,
definitely.
It tackles some big issues. It basically pre-Black Mirror.
No, it's like Twilight Zone and Black Mirror are, you know, they're the same, 2 sides of the same coin.
Exactly, they're cut from the same cloth.
Definitely.
For sure.
Lots of metaphors. There have been many iterations of The Twilight Zone, one coming from Jordan Peele this year in 2019, but the most notable was the first iteration, which started in 1959 and aired on CBS.
Have you seen any of the other versions of it? The 1983
mean?
Twilight Zone series or the 2013? Oh, they're interesting. I actually just watched the 1983 one because there's a sequel to the third segment, It's a Good Life, that they did in the 2011 or 13 one. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was hosted by Forrest Whitaker. Yeah, and the sequel is actually really fucking good.
Interesting.
The series itself, I don't think, but that particular episode was fantastic.
No, I haven't seen any of the iterations. As far as I was aware, it was
just one and
the
done.
One, like the this one, and then the original, and then the 2019 version.
Oh, interesting. No, this is the 2019 will be the fourth reboot, not including the movie. Kind of cool.
Interesting. Yeah, I did not know that. For many major blockbuster filmmakers of the 70s and 80s, The Twilight Zone was a childhood staple and helped guide their storytelling ambitions. They grew up hearing, you know, this on their TV screens.
And can you do it? Can you
I'm
do
not
Rod
going.
Sterling's voice?
You should do it because Let's I don't see. Have the voice for it.
Let me see if I can do it. There's a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
That was really good. Oh my gosh, I got shivers. Good job. But yeah, so that is your brief synopsis about The Twilight Zone.
Yep, and as we said before, The Twilight Zone was hugely influential to the blockbuster filmmakers that before blockbusters existed, actually. Before there was the first blockbuster,
right.
Which the person responsible for badly wanted to do The Twilight Zone. So, we're going to talk about two people here. Mr. Steven Spielberg and Mr. John Landis, which play a big part in the making of this film. So, Growing up, Steven Spielberg was obsessed with The Twilight Zone and had vowed that one day he would direct an episode in some way, shape, or form. He actually got to work with Rod Serling, with a Rod Serling property as his directorial debut. It was the pilot episode of Night Gallery, an anthology horror series set in a museum where each painting represented a different tale. And again, you'll see that in the Treehouse of Horror as well. Spielberg's segment was called Eyes, wherein a rich blind woman gets a new pair of eyes that allow her to see for only one brief, iconic moment.
Ironic or iconic?
Iconic, I think.
It says ironic.
Ironic moment.
Because
ironic
I believe moment. She gets her eyes and then she gets murdered.
Oh. And is that, she the, gets is to that see. The story?
I this sounds familiar. I could be completely bullshitting this.
Interesting. Well, it exists somewhere on YouTube. We can check it out at some point.
Yeah,
In just a few short years from his late 1969 directorial debut, Steven Spielberg would change the film industry forever. And we mean this, fucking change it. But we'll actually get to that when we cover Jaws at some later date. As she rolls her eyes. It is technically a horror film, though.
Is it?
Yeah. It's a blockbuster. The first blockbuster was also a horror film, and that's Jaws. It's a monster movie. It's interesting.
But sharks.
I know. Well, sharks are their own thing.
I know, but I love sharks.
That's true. Sharks are pretty badass.
And also, I just didn't like Jaws because they were being mean to the shark. Sharks are my favorite animal, in case anyone was at all curious. Oh, but
I used to love orcas back in the day. But, well, you know, we wanted to be marine biologists.
Yeah. We were both, like, super into that shit.
Yeah, orcas were my dogs, though.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. By 1982, though, Steven Spielberg was an established Hollywood mega director. And I think he was the mega director.
Mm-hmm.
He had birthed the modern blockbuster, of course, with, as we just said, 1975's Jaws. He had also done Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1977, Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, and E.T. the Extraterrestrial in the very same year that they were developing Twilight Zone movie. Steven Spielberg was motherfucking untouchable.
No, totally. At this time, he's like rolling out film after film after film, and they're all fucking gold.
They're all gold except 1941, which we'll get into right now, actually. The opportunity to make his childhood dream of helming a Twilight Zone episode would finally appear when Warner Brothers approached him on taking the reins of their adaptation of The Twilight Zone. The first attempt to do this, though, was actually in the mid-70s, and was actually a feature-length version of one of the segments that you'll see in this film. In an interview just a year prior to his death, Rod Serling stated, let me see if I do his voice again. No, I can't do it. I'm on my third draft of a feature film based on Jerome Bixby's short story, It's a Good Life. We did it originally on The Twilight Zone, but now we're doing a full-length version. Alan Sandberg, who produced Chariots of the Gods, Landsberg, he produced Chariots of the Gods, is producing it. It's a fantasy horror genre. It's in the fantasy horror genre. So yeah, that's what Serling wanted to do for the Twilight Zone movie. Unfortunately, in 1975, he actually died of a heart attack and never got to submit his draft into production. Shame. He was only like 50 years old, I think.
Really?
Yeah, he's pretty young.
Sucks.
Yep. Warner Brothers then began working with Carol Serling, Rod Serling's wife, on another version of a Twilight Zone film with the intention of only doing one story. This story turned into the film Miracle Mile, which was eventually released in 1988. The synopsis reads, a young man hears a chance phone call telling him that a nuclear war has started and missiles will hit his city in 70 minutes. This one actually, though, turned out to be a commercial flop in 1988.
That sounds like such a cool synopsis, though.
I do love it. I think actually it would have made a really good 30-minute Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, it would have been great.
Absolutely. I don't know about feature length.
Yeah, feature length, I feel like there's not enough there, but for a short, like, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. That would have been great. Yeah, a segment. It would have been cool. Spielberg had finally had the golden opportunity here to update the Twilight Zone for modern 1980 audiences, and he chose to bring his good friend, John Landis, to co-produce the film alongside him. As a high school dropout turned film director, Landis had made it big in the horror genre just prior with American Werewolf in London. But had also seen huge successes in different genres, particularly Animal House and The Blues Brothers, which would go on to become iconic American films. These are very American films. Have you heard Animal House, Blues Brothers?
I've heard of them. I've never seen them.
They're huge in the 70s. Fucking huge.
I remember, like, a lot of Blues Brothers references growing up, But, like, I remember, like, asking my mom about it. And she's like, it's not an appropriate movie. You can never watch it.
That's funny.
And so, to this day, I just never watched it because I'm like, it's not an appropriate movie. I stay as a whole-ass 23-year-old.
Fucking watching the Poughkeepsie tapes and shit. You're like, but I'm not going to watch the Blues Brothers. Please, I have standards.
No, it's just, like, it just is residual from my childhood and my mom being like, it's not an appropriate movie.
Oh, that's awesome. But, interestingly enough, the Blues Brothers was actually one of the most expensive films to make in its time, budgeting in at around $30 million in 1978 money, or 1970s money, with Steven Spielberg's 1941 budgeting at $35 million that same year. It is rumored that both directors were locked in a rivalry over who could make the most expensive film at the time. So these guys know they're good, and they're just like, let's see who can bring the budget up.
Also, because of my many tours of the Universal backlot, I'm familiar with the Blues Brothers in, like, that context, in, like, filming it, and some of the things that they had to do to make it, and why it's so expensive in terms of special effects. They destroyed several cars.
Oh, I'm actually getting to that right now.
Oh, okay.
They were, however, close friends during this time period, and even made cameos in each other's films, with Spielberg as an unnamed desk clerk in Blues Brothers, and Landis as a messenger in 1941.
Aw, yeah. That's nice.
Spielberg had a reputation for working very closely with children, ensuring the best performances and making the production a safe, welcoming environment for any children on his set. And this is really notable in his works on Jaws, Close Encounters, and E.T., where children were featured prominently. So, and that's true, because directors mostly hate working with children. They fucking hate it. But directors like Spielberg and Chris Columbus and them, like, they somehow are able to get really good performances out of him and take care of them.
Yeah, well, I think, that makes sense. Or it's nice anyway.
It's like unusual.
Because kids in Hollywood, like, grow up to be, like, traumatized.
Yeah, they definitely,
like,
fucking do.
They grow up to be Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah. Well, no, Culkin's pretty, has his head on a swivel.
He's great now. He was not great for a very long time.
Well, I think actually because his publicist would not let him do certain things.
So
he's got a whole story going with that one. But yeah, he's just weird now.
He's cool, but I follow him on Instagram. I'm just like, you're cool.
Yeah, he's funny. He's funny. John Landis, however, had a bit of a reputation in Hollywood as being a rule breaker and an extremely dominating presence on set. He was also known to be deceptive in order to get the shot that he needed. But this may have been apparent in other ways. Another example of his recklessness is during the filming of Blues Brothers, where he went overboard with special effects. In that film, he dropped a car from a helicopter, destroyed a shopping mall, and wrecked 60 police cars in the name of humor. So,
ha ha ha,
60 police goddamn cars, goddamn. In an interview, John Carpenter notes that Landis had claimed that in order to get his first feature approved, he vouched for Carpenter to get his first film made as well. Immediately after this, though, Carpenter states, I don't remember it in that way, but that's okay. John Landis claims a lot of things. Yeah, so you know Carpenter.
Carpenter's also just being a shady bitch here.
Carpenter don't lie, though. He's very blunt.
No, that's true.
Yeah, but he's very like, fuck you. Like, that's Carpenter. We know. We've covered Carpenter a couple times.
Yeah.
He's a motherfucker. Landis, though, also may have had a bit of a cocaine problem, as evidenced by
having a cocaine problem in the
80s? Oh, my God. Well, this is evidenced by the Blues Brothers legitimately having a designated cocaine budget.
Holy shit.
On the books. On the books, Alex. That's awesome. All right.
So, how much money did you spend on cocaine?
Well, they had John Belushi, so probably a lot.
Holy shit.
Yes. But
between Landis and Belushi?
Oh, my God. So then everybody, man. Yeah.
It's true. It was the
Carrie
80s.
Carrie Fisher, if she was in this bitch. But Landis and Spielberg's careers came up during the 70s, where studios would give final cut and creative control to any director that could make it big at the box office, looking past any indiscretions on set. And this is if we cover a lot more 70s stuff for the big dogs, they get away with a lot. They get away with a lot because they are bringing the dough. They're like the car salesman that's doing coke in the restroom. And they're like, well, he's selling all the cars, so we'll just let him keep doing his thing.
conveniently ignore the fact that he's, you know, doing lines in the bathroom.
He needs that energy, though. You gotta pump it out. You're like, yep, you want this Datsun?
Oh my God. You want this Datsun.
Yeah, but with all this, though, they gotta start making this movie now. Alex, let us know how that fucking happened.
So we are building in an anthology.
We totally are.
The plan for Twilight Zone, the movie, had now switched from being a single film to an anthology, And with that, it required additional directors to do the three segments planned in the film. Landis was tasked with one segment as well as the prologue. Spielberg would take another, while future Gremlins director Joe Dante would take on the remaining segment.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Dante had just come off of the very successful werewolf film The Howling, which utilized state-of-the-art special effects courtesy of Rob Bottin, whose next project would be John Carpenter's The Thing before joining Dante again in The Twilight Zone.
And those special effects in The Thing.
Holy
shit. Oh, yeah. And in this movie, too, fucking Bottin is a motherfucker.
No, yeah. Because we saw The Thing recently.
Yeah, we did. In theaters,
which was super, super cool. And the special effects hold up tremendously well.
Dude, they so fucking hold up. And it's kind of cool, though, too. These two directors, Landis and Dante, had a werewolf film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's nice.
Well, also, I think werewolf films were also kind of on the rise at this time
true.
As well.
Mm-hmm. And then they died.
Yeah. Dante had known Steven Spielberg's story editor, Mick Garris, since around 1980, and Garris felt that Dante's recent successes would be a good fit for the film and bring other investors to the project.
All about the money in Hollywood, son.
Yeah. Dante was tasked with the segment It's a Good Life, about a young boy with the ability to alter reality, who makes everyone bend to his childish whims.
It's my favorite one of the whole thing. Which we'll just break this down.
We'll break it down. Mm-hmm. Dante was very excited about this segment, as it allowed him to employ his love of cartoons into the segment, as the story was based around the psychology of a disturbed child, and holy shit.
Does he fucking do that? Does mm-hmm. he do it? Yep.
Spielberg and Landis soon found themselves not satisfied with just three segments and opted to add a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Steven Spielberg had just actually watched a little film called Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, and was very impressed with the film. He then felt he had to seek out the director. Have you seen any of the original Mad Maxes?
I've seen all of them except Beyond Thunderdome.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any of them. I was just curious.
Oh, yeah. No, I've seen them.
I saw the new one.
I love the new one.
Yeah, I saw the new one. Like, mm-hmm. I think that film and one of the Fast and the Furious films, I saw the most in theaters. Like,
really?
Ever. Like, Mad Max, I'm pretty sure I saw 5 or 6 times in theaters.
Did people just keep wanting to watch it or what?
I kept wanting to watch it. Like, DJ and I went to go see it in theaters like 4 or 6 times.
It's
like
such a good theater experience. I saw it in theaters too.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, George Miller's the shit, and this guy also did Babe. George Miller has Happy Feet. He did Happy Feet too.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, and this fucking film. So yeah. George Miller's got some versatility.
Yeah, no, he has. Yeah, no, totally. So Australian director George Miller had just come off two oddly successful films, Mad Max and The Road Warrior, when he received the offer to direct a segment of the Twilight Zone movie from Steven Spielberg himself.
Himself. He called him directly.
Miller was a fan of the series as well as of Spielberg's work and signed on almost immediately because mm-hmm. who fucking wouldn't?
Yeah, the biggest fucking director called me personally to do one segment of a show I idolize?
Yeah.
Give me 1 second. Fucking dancing.
It's just like, excuse me, I need to consult with my
agent. 1 second,
Mr. 1 second. Put the phone down. Yes. The answer is yes.
Sorry.
But he was tasked with directing a remake of Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. This story involves a man who has a fear of flying encountering a disturbing creature that picks apart the plane's engine mid-flight. The worst part, he's the only one who can see it.
Yep. And that is a story, like, that's American iconography right there
mm-hmm,
at this point.
Totally. William Shatner starred in the original episode and was actually offered the part, but was forced to turn it down due to prior commitments.
Damn.
Which sucks, but also John Lithgow took his place, so yep. That's kind of like, mm-hmm. you know. The original segment was directed by Richard Donner, director of The Omen, so Miller had some very big shoes to fill. I did not know Donner directed the original.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, though.
That is super cool.
Yeah, because the original is still really well directed.
Yeah, totally. Ugh. It's really well directed. So I think that's really interesting. There's a lot of, like, great directors involved with Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah, a talented staff, which mm-hmm. is crazy, because, it was a hit, but it wasn't, like...
Yeah.
Like, fucking, you know, whatever big numbers the regular sitcoms are doing out there. It's crazy.
Original Twilight Zone series writer Richard Matheson was brought on to adapt 3 of the segments for the big screen, including Spielberg's still-yet-to-be-determined segment. Matheson had written 16 episodes of The Twilight Zone, including A World of His Own, Nick of Time, The Invaders, and the original Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
Okay, of those ones, though, which ones are the ones that your favorite?
Nick of Time.
Nick of Time. Nick of Time's a good one. I like that.
I think.
I like Nightmare, and of course, I like The Invaders a lot.
I don't remember the Invaders one.
Oh, it's cool. It's like, I don't want to explain it all.
But John Landis was given rein to create his own original tale to open the film, which he initially called The Bigot. His intention was to make a segment representative of the social political commentary the Twilight Zone was known for. So.
Nice, yeah. I mean, it made sense, though, too, in the segment, yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. The main influence was an episode of the original series called A Quality of Mercy, though the plots differ greatly. In this segment, a commanding officer is given a look at the war through the eyes of the enemy after demanding his men attack a weakened Japanese force in one of the last battles of the Second World War.
It's actually a really good episode.
That sounds amazing.
It's fucking awesome. I love that one.
Okay, yeah, I've never seen it.
Very different than the movie version,
though. Oh, yeah.
Very different.
So, yeah.
Thematically similar, though.
Which reminds me, I definitely saw the first little vignette.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I might have seen this movie once upon a time, but...
Back though,
it was
right?
So distant that mm-hmm. like parts of it I'm like, oh, this is familiar, or the child yeah. thing, like I remember that.
Well, but, yeah, same here. Actually,
see, it had to have been like
you were nine.
Yeah, it had to have been at least like 9 years ago. Like, mm-hmm.
yeah.
you know?
No, yeah, same though. I've always known these stories, mm-hmm. but like I can never pinpoint when I first watched them. I just have always known them.
Yeah, I remember watching some in like my aunt's like family room, mm-hmm. like that I remember. But like other than that, it's just most of it is just like. It's like a planted memory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just part of your fabric, basically. Yeah.
The theme would remain intact, but the story itself would increase greatly in scope, making the character a regular, though bigoted, individual, having him live through various injustices alongside the people he had previously dehumanized, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
John Landis would write this segment as well as direct, being the only person in this group of directors to do so.
Yeah, special privileges here.
Yeah. Originally, the producers wanted to use past Rod Sterling narration for each segment, but eventually decided to use updated narration with the voice of Burgess Meredith, who starred in classic Twilight Zone episodes Time Enough at Last and The Obsolete Man, and a couple of others. They eventually decided to end the film with Rod Sterling's voiceover.
Oh,
thank
have you seen?
Christ.
Yeah, no, that was actually really badass. Every time I hear it, it's oh, yeah. fucking badass.
Well, here's the thing, it's like... If for me, because I've only ever watched Rod Sterling's The Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. anytime I hear someone else try to do the voiceover,
it's fucking weird.
It's not it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't hit the same heartstrings. Mm-hmm. However, that being said, Jordan Peele doing it, fucking reaction.
Yeah. Of Time Enough at Last and The Obsolete Man, which one do you think is the top dog?
I think Time Enough at Last.
Really? Oh, The Obsolete Man for me.
I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but both of those have been done... referenced a lot as well. Iconic yeah. fucking episodes, man.
Totally.
Dude.
When all was said and done, the film would have cast 6 Academy Award nominated actors. Dan Aykroyd, Albert Brooks, John Lithgow, Burgess Meredith, Kathleen Quinlan, and Kevin McCarthy.
Hmm. So 6 Academy Award people, those directors, there's a lot riding
yeah,
on this shit.
No, there's like, this has all, again, it's all the right steps, but the wrong fucking answer.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good film, but like, wrong fucking answer in terms of like, people died.
Mm-hmm.
But Spielberg was still mulling over which segment to make his own, but he had 3 options to choose from. The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, Kick the Can, and an original story where a bully gets his comeuppance on Halloween night. His decision was to be made after Landis's segment was completed and Spielberg's yet-to-be-determined segment was scheduled to be the last one filmed.
Ooh, I really would have liked to seen the bully getting his come up into Halloween. That seems like a really cool...
I think that seems like it seems very Spielberg-y.
Yes, it does. And I don't know why. I can see his visual style with the mm-hmm. costumes and everything and suburbs yeah, actually coming through pretty well.
No, but I did like Kick the Can.
Really? I hated it.
I mean, I liked it. I was mm-hmm. also, again, wine drunk watching it.
it's just too sentimental for me. I don't know what it is.
It was too... happy.
Yeah, it was very happy.
Like, well, that's the thing, is like, whenever I'm watching The Twilight Zone, I have to mentally prepare to have my heart ripped out by the mm-hmm. end of it. So as I was watching it, I was just like, what's gonna happen? What's gonna happen?
Ooh.
And nothing yeah. tragic really happened.
No, it didn't, no. But it was still very Twilight Zone, because they do have episodes like that.
It was very whimsical.
Whimsical, yes, that's the way of putting it.
It was very fantasy.
Yeah, fair. Yeah, we'll talk about it when we get to it. Yeah, sorry. We gotta go through each of the segments.
No, sorry. So, with everything in place, Spielberg and Landis envisioned a complete revitalization of the Twilight Zone, where future sequels would allow other directors to make segments and keep the franchise in the minds of Americans. Now the film just needed to be shot.
Mm-hmm.
The first segment to be filmed would be John Landis's newly titled Time Out, and what would follow would be one of the most horrifying acts in film history. Three people would lose their lives, and Hollywood would be changed forever.
It really would, actually. Like, the standards increased tremendously after mm-hmm. this shit. But, of course, to go forward, you get to learn about the people involved in this one. So, we're going to talk right now about actor Vic Morrow. And he was in a strange place in his career at the time of his casting in Twilight Zone, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was a leading man in the 60s, starring in one of the longest-running World War II dramas ever, Combat! Exclamation point. Always got to say exclamation point.
Mm-hmm.
In 1958, Morrow married actress Barbara Turner and had two children with her in their 7-year marriage, Carrie Ann Morrow and Jennifer Lee Morrow. After his divorce with Barbara Turner, Vic had a falling out with his daughter Jennifer, who changed her name to Jennifer Jason Lee in order to not be publicly associated with her father, which she would go on to have a pretty amazing career, actually. You know Jennifer like Jason Lee, right?
Mm-mm.
You ever seen Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
No.
Have you seen... Oh, you don't like Tarantino, Hateful Eight?
No.
Okay, you'll recognize her, trust me. The way Jennifer describes it, her sister Carrie was more of a daddy's girl, while she herself was more of a mama's girl. Huh? She had took on the name of Jason based on a family friend who was close to her mother. Jennifer Jason Lee and Vic Morrow remained estranged for the rest of his life.
Jesus.
Even with his personal woes, Morrow was very active in directing, particularly television directing. Because of his passion behind the camera, Morrow would often fluctuate between his acting and directing duties, proving to be very capable in both fields. That nice. Is until the 70s, because his leading man work was not nearly as prominent, and then he began focusing more on TV movies and directing some television episodes here and there. He notably, though, had a major role in the 1976 film, The Bad News Bears, which I guess everybody from the 70s freaking remembers this one. So, yeah. Pretty good. Yeah.
It's also a sports movie, right?
Yes, it's a baseball movie.
Yeah, it's a baseball movie, which mm-hmm. I don't like, so.
Yeah. It's about kids' baseball, though. It's very interesting.
I don't
yeah.
like The Sandlot either.
You don't like The Sandlot?
I've seen it once.
Okay. I'm sorry. I've seen it, like... A lot. It was one of the go-tos when we were kids, for sure. But during the early 80s, his career put him squarely in B-movie territory. He would star in films such as Humanoids from the Deep and The Last Shark, the latter of which was accused of plagiarizing Spielberg's own Jaws. This caused The Last Shark to be blocked from theatrical release within a month, which is fucking hilarious.
That is really funny.
Yeah, although it did make a good amount of money in that month. It just got, and it was too mm-hmm. much of a ripoff. He had recently finished filming a part in the Italian ripoff of Escape from New York called 1990, The Bronx Warriors, when he got the part in John Landis's first segment of Twilight Zone movie Time Out. He would play bigot Bill Connor in the leading role. Which,
great. Yes. Imagine, like, just slowly but surely falling through Hollywood ranks before someone approaches you, and it's just like, we want you to be a fucking racist.
Yeah. I don't know if I can play in a Steven Spielberg movie. Okay. I'll do it.
I wonder if there was any, like, beef between Spielberg and him, though, because if he was, like, blatantly accused of plagiarizing. Like, yeah. I don't know if that just seems interesting.
I feel Spielberg's like, you know what? Let's throw him a bone here. Let's see what real Hollywood's like.
Let's make him say the N-word on television. Yes.
It's fucking hilarious. Okay. 8 years prior, while filming Dirty Mary Crazy Larry in Dirty Mary Crazy Larry. I'm not doing it. In 1974, Morrow insisted on having a $1 million life insurance policy before he would shoot any scenes involving the helicopter in which he was due to ride. When asked why, Morrow replied, "I've always had a premonition I was going to die in a helicopter crash." This was 1974. Yeah.
Did he die in the helicopter crash?
Let's read on, Miss Webster.
Okay.
You got the next part.
Okay.
And we're going to lead into Landis' segment here, but go for it.
Micah Dinh Lee was born on January 23rd, 1975 in Vietnam. He was born to Daniel Lee and Hoa Kha Lee, who would flee a war-torn Vietnam and raise Micah in America. The family had actually left in one of the last boats available during the fall of Saigon.
That's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
That was intense.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel would go on to become a clinical psychologist, though would notably recall in a later testimony that he saw lots of explosions in his time in Vietnam. He had first started witnessing explosions at around the age of 10, according to later court testimony. Hoa K. Lee would go on to be a social worker in San Jose.
Hmm.
Just over a year later, Renee Chen would be born on April 1st, 1976 in Taiwan to Mark and Shia Hui Chen.
I think it's Shia.
Shia? Sorry. Shia Hui Chen, who would make their way to America to raise Renee. Mark Chen's brother, Peter, heard from a friend of his that there was an opportunity for his daughter Renee to be featured in a Hollywood film, Steven Spielberg and John Landis's adaptation of The Twilight Zone. He was approached by Donna Schumann, a production secretary, and a meeting was set up with associate producer George Fulzy Jr.
I fucking hate this guy.
Really?
Oh, you'll find out.
Peter Chen worked with Donna's husband, Harold, at a mental health center that served the city's Asian community.
It's kind of funny. Yeah, these are just regular fucking
yeah,
people.
Yeah, these just, like, and they're not, like, there's not a lot of name, like, no recognition or anything. These mm-hmm. are just normal fucking people.
Normal people who want to be part of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy.
So, but there is no information available about how Micah Din Lee was cast in the film. The parents of Micah and Renee were all told that the scene their children would be present in would take place in a Vietnamese village that was being bombed, and that the children would be the only two survivors of the assault and would be saved by Vic Morrow's character.
Mm-hmm. Bill Connor, racist motherfucker.
The filming was to take place at an abandoned motorcycle track at Indian Dunes Park, north of Los Angeles. This was a popular filming location for many productions, as it was far enough away from the city to not be affected by the city lights, but it was also very isolated, making for an easy shoot. The terrain was also varied, making it a perfect stand-in for a fictional Vietnam, and the set was big enough to allow for the use of multiple explosive devices.
Yeah, the area was actually used pretty recently for that that one Adam McKay film just came out. I forget what it was called. Vice.
Mm.
Yeah, no, it was pretty. Yeah, I was looking at it and like some of the behind-the-scenes stuff.
They still use it?
Yeah, they still use the Santa Clarita area in which all this stuff was shot. Yeah.
According to later testimony by Hoa K. Lee, Micah's mother, Fulzy never told them that they would be filming after dark and without the legal permits required for child actors, which, like, yikes.
Yeah, that's already pretty fucking bad.
Mm-hmm. None of the parents were told that there would be pyrotechnics and a helicopter so close to their children. And Lee later testified that Fulzy Jr. led her to believe that the bombing and destruction would take place before her son was due to appear on set. This is important.
Mm-hmm, because, yeah, there's a lot of deception here.
Yeah. The children were driven to the set the day before filming was set to take place, and the parents were given $500 for the use of their children in the film.
Yeah, it's supposed to be $500 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, only 2 days of work, I believe.
Okay. What they didn't know is that their children were being hired illegally and the payment was being made under the table. This is because Landis opted not to submit a special waiver to allow the children to be filmed in such a scene, as he was certain the waiver would have been denied. Considering the scene included massive amounts of water, Morrow was to carry the kids across a river, explosions, and a helicopter, it was likely that the waivers being denied was all but guaranteed.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Yeah.
you can't do that.
You can't just carry children through water.
You're
like,
yeah, we're going to put flames all around you and like it'll be fine. You know, there's six.
Yeah. The helicopter was to be flown by Vietnam veteran Dorothy Wingo, who had not done film or stunt work prior to being hired in the film. This is a clusterfuck.
They're taking advantage of a lot of people who want to be part of Hollywood.
Yeah. During rehearsals, some of the explosions had buffeted the helicopter Wingo was piloting, but he told no one about his concerns.
Fucking, he really wanted to be in the movies.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Micah, Renee, as well as their parents, were not aware of the explosive rehearsals. They were placed about a quarter of a mile away around this time.
Yes.
With everything in place, the last of John Landis's segment would be filmed on July 23rd, 1982. Sometime prior to shooting date, George Folsey Jr. told Donna Schumann that if anyone found out about this, our asses would be in jail. That is a direct quote.
Mm-hmm. That's what she testified. Yep.
The parents of Micah Din Lee and Renee Chen were ecstatic that their children were going to appear in a Hollywood film.
Oh, yeah.
So, this is where...
This is going to be where we're going to cut off for a second, guys, if you guys don't like graphic depictions of things.
More importantly, if child death upsets you,
yes,
like skip ahead.
Skip ahead like 10-15 minutes. It'd be okay. Yeah. Because this is
if that's all you need to know. If mm-hmm. like if we're not going to really talk a whole lot about it, other than like the legacy and the tragedy of it.
Yeah, afterwards.
But just know they died.
Yeah. All right. So filming again. It took place on July 23rd, 1982. After 3 straight weeks of night shooting, the crew was finally ready to shoot this climactic scene of Time Out, but up until this point, the shoot was rumored to be pretty chaotic and definitely behind schedule. These guys were fucking exhausted. On the day of the shoot, rehearsals were set to take place, with the final sequence being around 2 a.m., which is fucking late. And of course, you cannot have children out that late.
No.
But that's only if you hire them legally. The scene in the screenplay read exactly as follows. The helicopter makes another pass, and then one of the huts explodes in a spectacular fireball. Bill, holding a child in each arm, makes a Herculean effort and runs for the shallow river. With the huts burning behind him, Bill runs as best he can across the river. So, that's just one blurb, and they put a lot of dollars behind that one blurb.
Mm-hmm.
Folsey wanted to take the children to the rehearsals by himself, but Micah's mother, Hoa K. Lee, insisted that the parents should be present for the shoot. During rehearsals, the crew filmed the scene over several takes without any special effects or helicopter, just the children running with Morrow through each of their marks. Micah and Renee were laughing and giggling as they went through the motions, which Landis was trying to direct the children to stop doing.
Yeah, you're terrified.
Yeah, he's just like, don't laugh during this, guys. This is actually supposed to be pretty not that.
Yeah.
At some point during this, Renee Chen started crying, prompting Landis to carry her over to her mother, Shia Chen, who asked her daughter if she was scared. She responded, "A little bit. I have sand in my eye." She also told her Mara was holding onto her too tight. Shia then changed Renee from her wet clothes to dry clothes, and afterward was approached by Folsey, who, according to later testimony, told her, "If fire department people come over and ask you what you are doing here, tell them you are friends helping us. Don't mention money."
At that point, you take your child and you're like, thank you, have a nice mm-hmm. day, goodbye.
Well, see, they're taking care of people who are completely... They're taking on people who are ignorant to this whole process.
That's so
to this
up.
Whole process
That's
and
so
taking advantage of them.
Fucked up.
There are other quotes I actually didn't put in here that show you how fucked up this whole process was. One of them including Landis. But Daniel Lee was also told not to inform the fire safety officer that they were to be part of the actual filming. Yeah. Before heading to the final shoot, Hoa K. Lee found herself exhausted as the shoot was heading into the AM hours, and she had been on set all day with her child all day. So the previous day, she was actually there until about 4 a.m. And then she was exhausted from this one, so they kind of wore her down. Folsey informed Lee that she did not need to come back to the set and instead would take Micah himself. He told her, "I will treat your child as if it was my own." Lee agreed to this and sent her son off with Folsey. This would be the last time she would see her child again.
It's so fucked.
Yeah, it's gonna get there. Just prior to shooting of the helicopter scene, Morrow and the children went through a few more lines in rehearsals. Noticing the helicopter and text explosions, Shia Chen asked George Folsey if her daughter was in any danger. Folsey patted her on the shoulder and told her confidently, "Not dangerous, very loud." Lighting for the scene proved difficult as the grips had needed to climb a 30-foot scaffolding in order to properly light the scene, while being surrounded by explosions and winds generated from the helicopter. Landis reportedly berated the electrical workers, saying, "Is there somebody on this electrical crew who's not too chicken shit to do the job?"
It's dangerous, Landis, you son of a bitch.
Just like we pointed out earlier, Landis was pretty goddamn dominating and did not give a shit about this kind of stuff. By law, Micah and Renee were well past time they would be legally allowed to work, but since they were paid under the table and the fire safety inspector was being kept in the dark, no one was there to enforce the law. Just after 2 a.m., Morrow began pacing nervously in front of the mock Vietnamese village that was to be bombed very shortly after. This would be Morrow's biggest break in a decade, a major boom to his fledgling career, and this fucking guy knew it. The shot had to be perfect, because the cost of rebuilding the village set to be blown up again would be too much for the already stressed production. They had one take to get it right.
That's so, like, just, like, the stress and, like, the pressure for something like that.
And the night shooting.
Doing something correctly, they're exhausted.
Yeah.
Oh. And plus, everyone's on edge because they all know they're doing something illegal.
Yeah. Well, at least the big dogs know.
Yeah.
And they're just working everybody. They're keeping everybody basically in the dark.
Right. But, like, the people who are calling all the shots mm-hmm. know what they're
they
doing.
They know exactly what they're fucking
so
doing.
So it's, like, tension is high on all fronts.
Oh, yeah. As the helicopter approached for the final rehearsal, Landis took a moment to give Vic Morrow a much-needed pep talk, and then made his way towards Micah and Renee, who had just been led to the set that very moment. Landis assuaged the parents' fears, which at the time included Daniel Lee and Shia Chen. They were both on set mm-hmm. during this. The person who was assigned with setting off the explosive noticed a mortar was underneath one of the huts they constructed on the set. He found this disturbing, but it was unclear if his fears were laid to Landis or any of the producers.
A mortar?
Yep. What? It's like a bomb.
What?
There's a bomb underneath one of the huts.
Oh, I didn't know what a mortar was.
Yep. There were at least four cameras, but around 4 to 6 cameras now set up to capture the sequence at all angles, with the helicopter and tending to fly about 42 feet above the flames. Now, I learned this later on. The legal limit at this time, you had to be at least 500 feet above. 500, not 42.
Jesus Christ.
And 42 is what they rehearsed. They would get lower. Around 100 members of the staff and crew sat back, ready for the sequence to finally be filmed. With cameras ready to roll, John Landis made his way into the shallow waters of the Santa Clarita River and signaled that it was time to shoot. While holding two children and waiting for the director to say action, Vic Morrow stated to a crew member, "I've got to be crazy to do this shot. I should have asked for a double." Those would be his last words.
Jeez.
Yep. Landis made his way back to the hill and shouted, "Action!" As explosions, pyrotechnic fireballs, and machine gun fire commenced lighting the Santa Clarita River with smoke and flames as the helicopter, a heavy steel warship, around 40 feet in diameter, made its way towards the set. Shia and Daniel were watching the filming a short distance back with the flames shot towards the sky. Daniel Lee became paralyzed in fear and fell to the ground as he saw a fireball shoot up so high it went up toward the top of a nearby cliff, bigger than any explosion he had seen in wartime Vietnam, according to later court testimony.
Fuck.
Yes. Vic Morrow held 7-year-old Micah Lee and 6-year-old Renee Chen and made his way toward the Santa Clarita River with just as rehearsed, but this time being surrounded with explosions rumored to be bigger than what they had initially planned. Shia Chen was watching Morrow and carry Micah and her daughter with John Landis behind her when she heard him yell into his megaphone, "Lower, lower," towards the helicopter, and "Fire, fire," for the special effects crew. Daniel Lee corroborated this in a later testimony, even though he was on the ground in terror at this time.
Jeez.
Production manager Dan Allingham, who was in the aircraft at the time, told veteran pilot Dorsey Wingo, "That's too much. Let's get out of here," just before Landis commanded the helicopter to be lowered. The warship descended from its planned altitude of 42 feet to 25 feet.
What?
As the cluster of grass huts exploded simultaneously, causing debris to fly into the night sky.
I have dived deeper than 25 feet. Like,
really?
From a diving board. Like, I've been in pools deeper than 25 feet.
Dude, he was 25 fucking feet.
Jesus Christ.
25 fucking feet. Yes. The winds from the chopper's blaze generated huge gusts that swirled throughout the set with bigger flames. So this is a fucking crazy scene right here.
Oh my God.
All right, guys. Ready for this one. As Vic Morrow was making his way through the water, he became startled by the noise of one of the explosions and lost his grip on Renee Chen, accidentally dropping her into the water. As he attempted to cover Renee, things suddenly took a turn for the worst. Some say it was a tin lid that hit the tail rotor, while others say it was the heat of the flames, up to 1,000 degrees, that weakened the protective coating of the rotor assembly. But either way, veteran pilot Dorsey Wingo lost control of the 40-foot steel warship directly above the three actors. Around 100 people watched in horror as a giant fireball engulfed the helicopter, sending it into a tailspin. In an instant, Renee Chen was crushed by the warship's right skid, while Vic Morrow and Micah Dinley were decapitated by the aircraft's main rotor. The next few seconds were filled with horror, shocked, and shocked silence, as well as genuine confusion.
Jesus.
I know. Landis, seemingly unaware of what just happened, yelled into his megaphone, "What the fuck is this helicopter doing in my shot?" But as the realization dawned on him, he immediately stated afterward, "Oh my god, where are Vic and Micah and Renee?"
Fuck.
Landis and second assistant director Anderson House, whose first major motion picture was this film, rushed towards the wreckage. Anderson reached down and picked up what he assumed was a dummy that fell out of the helicopter, as there was no blood and it felt rubbery. Quote-unquote rubbery. Then, Anderson looked toward the shore and saw the head of actor Vic Morrow. It dawned on him that he was not carrying a dummy, but rather Vic Morrow's torso. This caused him to yell out, "Oh my god." And the realization of what happened was beginning to dawn on the crew at this time. Brief moments later, an agonizing scream reverberated throughout the set. It was Shia Chen, who had just discovered the remains of her daughter. In her delirium, all she could do was plead with her daughter's lifeless body to wake up.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, Daniel Lee remembers... All Daniel Lee remembers is seeing panic among the crew when he finally came to, and he saw the chaos and noticed the body of his son, Micah. A voice woke up through the loudspeaker asking everyone to go home. Fire safety officer Jack Rimmer put a sheet over Morrow's body and made his way through the water in order to put out the fires in the makeshift village. In the water, he discovered the head of Micah. 5 minutes after the crash, pilot Dorsey Wingo and his crew were pulled from the wreckage. Wingo asked, "Where's Vic?" Someone then pointed to what remained of his body underneath the sheet, and it dawned on him what had actually happened. 4 people went to the hospital for injuries but were released shortly afterwards. The helicopter remained in place until an investigation could be completed in the following days, and Vic Morrow never got to deliver his final scripted line to the actors. That line was, "I'll keep you safe, kids, I promise. Nothing will hurt you, I swear to God."
Jesus fucking Christ.
This is the accident that changed Hollywood forever.
Yeah, I can tell why.
Yeah.
Rightfully fucking so. And you watch news like footage of this shit?
I watched newsreels of the... Basically how they... I mean, I've seen the footage too. But because it
is footage?
Back in the 80s?
They released it?
They were playing it on regular network TV. They were playing the full footage on network TV. Some networks cut away before the helicopter fell. But some networks played the full fucking thing from as many angles as they can get. And it was crazy seeing it because it's news from the 80s. It's very sensationalized. It's very different.
So sad. But I'm going to start crying. That's awful.
I was seeing these newsreels, this footage, it's fucking insane, man.
That's devastating. Oh my God.
The way they look at it, after it was all done, which you'll get to here coming up, but it was basically Hollywood was finally exposed for the kind of bullshit.
Oh, what, for like under the table bullshit?
For all the shady deals, now there was a big microscope on these fucking guys because of this recklessness that just happened.
Holy shit. Yeah. Oh God, okay.
Yeah, it's okay. You good? Are you good?
Because
you got to give us the aftermath here.
I know. So,
Alex is a little traumatized right now.
No, I'm sad. That's awful.
It's fucked up. Especially since these guys really wanted to be in this fucking movie. They badly wanted. Vic Morrow, dude, his career was in the shit.
Yeah, no. So, okay, let's go into this.
Let's do it.
The aftermath. So, if we went into the lengthy trial and fallout of what happened after this incident, it would be a much, much longer podcast. So, for brevity's sake, we'll hit up the major points. Steven Spielberg was devastated after learning of the incident, as he had a history of working closely with child actors, like we mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
The deaths of Micah and Renee haunted him. He severed all ties with John Landis and vowed never to speak to him again.
Good fucking work right there.
Right. Yeah. No, totally. Spielberg was so distraught over the incident, he nearly left the project completely, but after a call with an executive, decided to complete his contractual obligation. He initially was leaning towards filming The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, but seeing as it was a night shot that would require child actors and had an overall bleak message, Spielberg opted to take on Kick the Can instead. He wrapped up shooting as quickly as he could and moved on from the project.
Mm.
George Miller and Joe Dante's segments were filmed without any issues and were considered the highlights of the film by critics. 20 representatives from various agencies reviewed all angles of the crash. attempting to determine who was at fault and at what had actually happened.
Yeah, this is what the newsreels go into a lot of this stuff, because they needed to figure out what the fuck happened.
Yeah. Warner Brothers immediately put out a statement asserting that they did not know who hired the children, and the press began to investigate exactly what they were doing in the first place. There were also reports of drug and alcohol use on the set by local news, but that was never confirmed, right?
I don't know if it was... Yeah, there were just reports of it. Reports, I don't know if that was part of the trial. Oh, they did mention it in the trial.
Mm. There were three empty beer cans in the heli... What?
Yeah.
All right. Do that again.
Do it again. Go for it. Yeah. I'm going to keep that in for the outrage.
What?
I'm going to keep it in for the outrage.
There were three empty beer cans in the helicopter, but investigators couldn't determine if they had any effect on the crash. Are you fucking kidding me?
They couldn't prove that they drank it.
I know. I hate this shit.
This is Hollywood in the 80s, Alex. No fucking rules.
Daniel Leigh changed his name to Daniel Leigh after the incident. Mm-hmm. Around 150 to 200 of Vic Morrow's family and friends attended his funeral in Culver City, which was held the same day the film segment's wrap party was originally scheduled.
Damn.
Yikes.
Yep.
Landis gave a brief emotional eulogy at Morrow's funeral. Many of his co-stars from Combat! Exclamation point, were in attendance. Some, such as Morrow's longtime friend, Dick Peabody.
Cool fucking name.
Yes. Saw this as insulting, as he felt the eulogy was rambling and done at the behest of his lawyer. Landis was accompanied by his wife and George Folsey Jr.
Piece of fucking dickbag. Shit.
Regarding Vic Morrow's two drafted wills, he left Jennifer Jason Leigh $1 in his first will and $100 in his second. Douchey move, but yeah, I'll allow it.
They were estranged.
Never mind. Yeah. She had just made it big in the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High and had hoped that with her father's comeback, they would be able to work together in the future and settle their differences. Which sucks.
Yeah.
Morrow's tombstone reads, I loved him as dad. Mm-hmm. To everyone else, he was Vic. All right.
Yeah, that's actually what's on his tombstone.
All right, whatever. Twilight Zone, the movie, opened on June 24th, 1983, to middling reviews. Critics such as Leonard Maltin said that in viewing the first segment, Time Out, the thought of the deaths remained in his mind, as with many critics, and had an adverse effect on his viewing of the film. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, just as an aside, I watched it without knowing that this is...
Yeah, where... see, and you liked it.
I loved it because I didn't know children were murdered in the making of that snippet. Otherwise, mm-hmm, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much.
Well, see, we're going to definitely go into that coming forward. But yeah, a lot of critics at the time, they panned it mostly because... they couldn't see it beyond this. This shit
beyond
was in
the
news.
Tragedy, right?
You this was a yeah, big fucking
course,
case.
Of course,
yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. The film opened at number 4 to the tune of $6.6 million, though it was eventually profitable, making $29 million on a $10 million budget. This is far less than what the executives at Warner Brothers were expecting. I feel like part of that also has to do with people wanting to go see it because there was tragedy that was associated with it.
Yeah, yeah, that brought some people in there just to know what went into it.
Mm-hmm. Director John Landis, pilot Dorsey Wingo, and production manager Dan Allingham, associate producer George Folsey Jr., and explosive specialist Paul Stewart were tried on charges of manslaughter. It took 3 years to get any of them into a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck you guys. The trial was a major media event, and this was the first time a director would be tried for such a crime. Deputy District Attorney Leah Perwin DeAugustino hissed a murderer at Landis at some point in front of the press. She was up against 7 all-male defense lawyers, including a former Watergate prosecutor.
Yeah, so she's a defender. And she has 7 of these motherfuckers up against her. High-cost fucking lawyers. And I tell you, I've seen the footage. Everyone was playing fucking dirty.
Oh,
everyone
I'm sure.
was playing. This Watergate motherfucker?
This
oh
woman is my
God.
Hero.
Oh, dude. You should see some of the ways that she was fighting back. But you would actually hate it, though, because... they treat her like, oh, some fucking woman.
Like, yeah, I know, but, like, she, like, stood up to that shit.
Oh, she was fierce.
That's
she
what
was
I'm
fucking
saying.
Fierce,
that's why
dude.
I'm like, she's my fucking hero.
Yeah, what she was up against, holy fuck.
Yeah. The defense team asserted that the accident was unavoidable, and the jury agreed. Some witnesses feared that if they told the truth, they would be blackballed from the industry. Landis and the crew were then acquitted of all charges.
Yep.
fuck you guys.
Yeah, nothing happened to any of them. Even though they admitted in court they hired them illegally.
It's so fucked.
So fucked.
Warner Brothers set up numerous safety committees to prevent this kind of incident from happening ever again. Major studios began issuing the Injury and Illness Prevention Program manual to all employees. The industry saw a massive surge in hiring risk management specialists who cannot be fired by the director or the producers. Good fucking move.
Yes.
Ultimately, the parents of Micah Dinley and Renee Chen were awarded $2 million each for the wrongful deaths of their children. It is rumored that Carrie Ann Morrow and Jennifer Jason Leigh received a sum of around $900,000 from the... although the actual sum was never disclosed. Mm-hmm. Shia Chen, the mother of Renee Chen, has since stated that she thinks about the accident every day and basically has been spiraling into a deep depression ever since. Mm-hmm. John Landis has since stated that the film had traumatized him and had an adverse effect on his career. No fucking shit. Yeah. 2 years later, he directed the film Trading Places, starring Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. It was the third highest grossing film of 1988.
Yeah, real fucking adverse effect on your career. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any entertainment credits past 2015 and as of the release of this podcast.
Yeah, so I guess, to me, that just means he burned out like all the other directors from that fucking era. Not right. That it had an adverse effect on his career.
I'm so fucking...
Yeah.
I'm just like angry that they got acquitted.
They got away. They,
yeah.
Dude, at least put fucking George Fosse Jr. in that shit. Fosse Jr. Yeah. That motherfucker.
That's the thing that sucks is that they were all put on trial at once, which is unfortunate because then you're basically, it's a wall of Hollywood elites.
Yes.
And their horde of lawyers against one
defender.
Yeah, one district attorney.
Yeah, who would not get a benefit or like either, she could win or lose the case. Her career is going to be a district attorney either way. These guys get their careers based off acquittals. So it's like, dude, she was up against a fucking army here.
Yeah,
the industry, because they called this case Hollywood on trial. Yeah. Nobody had ever seen anything like this.
And that's the thing, is if you're advertising something like that or discussing something as Hollywood on trial, of course no one wants to, like, ruin Hollywood.
No. Yeah, exactly.
It's so fucked up.
They got the Watergate lawyer, man. They got the fucking Watergate lawyer.
I hate that shit. I hate defense attorneys.
Dude, no. Watching the trial, that shit was... I saw 2 hours
of... Is there a lot of court footage?
Yes.
I might have to look into it. It's fucking vicious. Because I do like court footage.
Oh, you might like this. I'll link it to you later because it's fucking vicious. And just seeing the way she talks to these guys, it's... a group of motherfucking dudes saying like, oh, you know, she's just trying to make a star of herself. She's like, they're talking down to her. And she was like, it makes me happy that they're so angry and they're ganging up on me because it means I'm doing something right. She is fucking vicious. But she even took it with grace when she lost.
Yeah.
Like, honestly.
Well, I think it was probably one of those things where it's like, I feel like she probably didn't have the intention of winning. Like, she wanted to win, but also I think she knew what she was going up against and she knew that... at least the court case was getting so much publicity that it would change the way things were done.
Yeah, no, she even expresses that. Like, even though I lost, you know, Hollywood has changed because of this, and I'm glad that at least that's out there. Mm-hmm. But, dude, even the jury's interviews after this, they pissed me off, too.
Really?
They were smug little motherfuckers. They're like, well, you know, we're not going to prosecute somebody over an accident that couldn't have been avoided.
It totally could have been avoided. Well, the helicopter was 25 feet off the ground.
Dude, some of the stuff was left out. The testimony of Micah's, two of the parents, their testimony was not given to the jurors because they felt that they would be a biased witness. They left it out.
It's their parents. What?
And it wasn't until they saw the footage, which was weeks into the case, that they realized that somebody had actually been decapitated. They didn't know what the fuck happened. These guys were left in the dark for a lot of it.
So they were just like, these children died on set.
Yeah.
We're not going to tell you what happened.
Yeah, decapitation wasn't a point until they finally saw the footage.
Fuck.
Yeah, it was fucking dirty. Dirty.
I hate this shit.
When you talk about the olden times, so you got to remember, like, everybody's like, you privilege shit like that. Like, no, dude, there's a lot of stuff against people who don't have money. And kill.
Yeah, hiring, like, you know, like, immigrant children from under the table. Like,
yeah.
That's... not
and these cool. People barely spoke English. They had to have translators for a lot of their testimony.
Really?
Yes. A lot of their testimony.
Awful.
Ugh, dude. Okay, but now that that's taken care of, you know, how does the knowledge of this tragedy affect your overall view of the film, and particularly the timeout segment?
I'm a lot less excited about the movie now.
I know. But I mean, how going into the story now, like, how does it affect your view of the story?
Like I said, the first one was my favorite. Now I'm just like, it's not my favorite at all. This is awful. I think that, like, I did not know any of this shit. No. I knew that there was a helicopter accident. I knew it rocked Hollywood forever. Kind of knew that children died, but, like, I didn't understand how fucked up the whole thing was.
Yeah. It's a lot of it. When he gets the details, it's just dirty.
Yeah. Honestly. No, it's awful. So how did, like, for you, having done all the research for this, how did watching the timeout segment?
I never liked it that much, because I remember when I was younger, mm-hmm. and being my least favorite. But I also didn't understand much about Nazis and all that stuff because I was a child.
Yeah.
But even now, like, I guess I think it's kind of a boring segment but I also feel like the ending, because I had seen the what thing it's based off of, which to me is very dialogue driven and actually a better story.
Yeah, because that was the original one was just Nazis, right?
No, it was the Japanese and American forces.
Yes, that one. Yeah.
It's A Quality of Mercy, which I highly recommend you guys watch. It's a very good segment. But to me, you know what sucks is I think the ending of having this character somehow redeem himself, maybe not in the way that it was shot, but in redeeming himself, would have made the segment way better. Because mm-hmm. they just ended with him being charted off.
Well, yeah, it's not specified, but he's being shipped off to a concentration camp.
He is. Yeah, exactly. And I feel like doing another little bit and then having him redeem himself would have been more Twilight Zone-y.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have liked the segment a little bit more. But even with the tragedy, once I learned about this tragedy, which was, I learned about it when I was like a teenager. Because, I don't know, it was macabre fucking teenager. Fucking weird. That changed me from there on. Mm-hmm. I was like, anytime I'd see it, I'm just like, fuck, it's just always in my mind.
Yeah.
Like, this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and it, even then, I've only seen, up when I first watched it, they had the video, but they'd always cut away. In the past few years, they've just let it on YouTube. But, I mean, they were playing it on the news. Which is fucking insane.
That is so wild to me that they just showed everything on the news.
Yeah.
Like, that is so wild to me.
But, I mean, it makes sense, too, that Spielberg would want to do something positive.
Totally. Yeah, like, now I get it. Now it makes total sense. Mm-hmm. Like, now I understand it being, like, put next to and kind of juxtaposed with Kick the Can.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, in the beginning of this episode, I was just like, I don't know, Kick the Can was too positive, and now I'm just like, I need that positivity.
Absolutely, right? Because that's how I feel, too. As much as I don't really like the segment Kick the Can, to me, the grimness I feel watching the first one is counteracted by Kick the Can.
Yeah, it's a palate cleanser.
It is. It's a total palate cleanser. And it kind of evens you out so you can get ready for the last two segments.
Yeah, because the last two ones are really good. And I understand now what you mean when you say the first two aren't your favorite.
Because,
mm-hmm. like, the first one was my favorite. And now I'm just, like, the last two are the ones. Those ones got to be it now.
Yeah. It's really weird seeing critic reviews from this time, because they have a hard time. They really do have a hard time separating this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. And how can you not?
Yeah. And they use it as an opportunity to dog on Spielberg, too. Like, and Spielberg has the most boring fucking one, which he does, but it's like, they take it a little far,
right? But also, like, he has the most boring one, but also it's still very well shot.
No, it's amazingly shot. It looks, and the music is fucking perfect. Great. The music is so good.
It's well directed. He did a good job, and I understand why he picked that one instead mm-hmm. of The Monsters on Maple Street, because it involves children and night shots, which was a little bit on the nose, don't you think?
No, that's true. And, you know, I've actually seen behind the scenes footage of all these being made.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, obviously I've seen the one for fucking the first one, but but even Kick the Can and stuff like that. And Spielberg does not put it on his face that he's basically broken at this point. He puts on his director face and a professional,
right,
smiling with the kids. Like, he really made a point to make the shoot fast and as smooth as possible, which I respect. Respect that tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And then cutting off John Landis. Good fucking job.
Right. No, that's like a really big, like, attaboy for him, for mm-hmm. Spielberg at this point, because, like, they were really good friends, and now, like, he was just like, you fucked up, you're not taking responsibility, get fucked, I'm never talking to you again.
Dude, don't even get me started on watching Landis's fucking testimony on here.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's tough. Oh, but Do you think either the Monsters of Maple Street or the Halloween Bully Story options would have been a better fit? Like, say if this accident didn't happen, or you just watched the movie as mm-hmm. as movie without any of this knowledge. Would you have preferred something more along the lines of these two?
I would have preferred the Halloween Bully. Now, this is me thinking to where I was last night.
Yes, yeah. How, when you watched it,
When I watched it before knowing what I know now, I think the Halloween Bully one would have fit much better.
Yes.
However, I 1,000% understand the creative decision in putting Kick the Can there after mm-hmm. the tragedy.
No, I actually agree with that move. Doesn't help for the film in terms of just overall separating it. It's true.
So someone, like, let's say in terms of the aging process, mm-hmm. like, in terms of, like, this film was made in the 80s and me watching it now, mm-hmm. I feel like if I had my brother watch it without the context of the tragedy, mm-hmm. and I told him, like, for Kick the Can, would you rather put in Monsters of Maple Street or the Halloween Bully Story, he would totally be like, Halloween Bully Story. Exactly. It would have fit so much better. Mm-hmm. So I think it really... Like, I can see why it would have it, people would have issues with it later on down the line.
Yeah.
Because if you're not aware of mm-hmm. the history behind it, it just doesn't fit
with
the tone of the rest of the film.
It really doesn't.
It's kind of disjointed.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the Monsters of Maple Street actually would have been really good,
too. I don't remember that
one. That's the one where all the lights go out and they know that there's a bomb that's going to happen. And they have to go into a shelter, but the shelter... can't take everybody in the neighborhood, so they have to figure out who's not going to be in there.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, well, you should watch it. It's one of the most iconic episodes of the series. People like always reference this one. I think it would have been a good representation of the Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. actually. But what are your thoughts actually on well, let's get a little more positive here, on It's a Good Life. What do you think of that one?
I really enjoyed it. I really, really liked the set design.
Yes.
Ooh. Was amazing.
Very Tim Burton-y.
Almost. Yeah, the Tim Burton-y, like, cartoony aspect. Before Tim Burton. Yeah, the cartoony aspect of it was really, really cool to me. I think mm-hmm. that it has that, like, it was unsettling, but also it was kind of towing the line between, like, funhouse mm-hmm. and, like, cartoony. To the point where I was just like, I don't know whether or not I should enjoy this or be terrified of it.
Yeah,
because, like, there were parts, like, when they're walking down the hallway and it, like, it's getting smaller and there's stripes and it's, like, the illusion of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, uncanny and it has that it gives you that unsettling feeling where you know this is not what a hallway is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
Or you know this is not what a house is supposed to look like. It reminded me, you've been to Disneyland, right?
Yes.
Have you been to Toontown?
Yes. So it's a lot like that. Yes.
It reminded me a lot of, like, Toontown, like Mickey Mouse's house, if it was, like, Mickey Mouse was a serial killer.
Yeah, and had blood coming from his fangs and
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, that's kind of what it reminded me of, like, that whimsical, cartoony aspect, but it was also, like, there were details, that's what it is, the details of it
mm-hmm.
that made it really disturbing.
Yeah, no, to me, this was, even as a kid, I think, you know, the kid's name being Anthony Freeman. Was it Freeman or Fremont?
I don't remember. But his name was Anthony. That's but all his I know.
Initials being AF, even younger, I was just like, those are my initials. But I'm like, oh, he's mean. Because, I don't know, it's a good character, though. Even watching, have you seen the original?
Yes.
What do you think about, I'll get into my thing. So, yeah, I've always known this story.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, seeing the original and then seeing this one, they're starkly different.
Yeah.
But I always love the art behind this remake because it stands out from everything. You got fucking Taz
mm-hmm.
coming out of a TV that's splitting apart and not like splitting apart how you would see a TV chopped down.
Right.
It's jagged.
And it's not even like a happy Taz. Like, no. It is a fucking demented. Terrifying Taz.
Yes. And like that kind of stuff, it was like, I don't know, my child mind was like, this is so cool, but still like freaked out by it. Like, it's weird because it's really is like nothing you probably have ever seen.
Mm-mm.
You just really haven't, because even like Who Framed Roger Rabbit and shit like that later on, like, they'd stay animated. They
right, the animation going into reality, like, they're able, like, the mm-hmm. mesh is a little bit different in a comedy film like Who Framed Roger Rabbit than this, which is, it becomes, you know, kind of claymation-y, kind of, like, grotesque.
Yeah.
And that's what's really
animatronic,
freaky.
Even, like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was some animatronic, like, the rabbit.
Bunny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the rabbit from the hat, dude. That scene was, like... And it's just a growing out of the hat. That's some good fucking special effect. That's a thing special effect right there.
Which, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We know it looks fucking amazing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I remember comparing both. I will say that the character of Anthony, you know, cool fucking name again. The character of Anthony is a lot more, he's pretty menacing in the original.
I kind of watched it and I was like, is this what Anthony was like as a child? I was projecting you onto Anthony.
Oh my gosh. Well, at least the movie version had a more positive ending where the woman's trying to like teach him and guide him.
Oh, you saw it as positive?
I mean, she's enslaved basically.
But no, I didn't view it that way at all. No?
How'd you view it?
When it ended, mm-hmm. and like in the end when they're like nowhere, mm-hmm. and she's like talking to him, I'm like, oh, she wants to learn how to do it too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she said it. Oh, let me be, that's right. Let me be your teacher and also your student.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I was just like, sense. She wants to learn how to do it. She, and it's just like, she's too calm. She's not like, she is too calm to the point where I'm just like, she wants to learn how to do it for her own nefarious purposes. That has to be it.
And, well, she never came off as nefarious prior to that to me, though.
Exactly. Yeah. She didn't become nefarious at all. But then, like, you can, like, see towards, like, the later part of the vignette.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can see the little wheels turning in her head, and she's like, I can manipulate this child to learn how to do this.
That's an interesting read. That's a very interesting read.
That's how I saw it.
Yeah, no, that's good. I actually like that.
Because,
well, the original's weird because it's just Bleak.
Mm.
He's just like, we're not, even though the voiceover's like, we're not here to teach you a lesson. Just an update as to what's happening in a little town in Ohio with this fucking kid. And, like, he makes a whole point to be like, there's no resolution. The kid just... It's just 22 minutes of the kid fucking with everybody and getting away with mm-hmm. it at the end. To where he doesn't really necessarily get away with it in this one. He mm-hmm. kind of understands what he's been doing and she centers him. But in the other one, he just gets away with it and is fine. And there's a sequel episode that I just saw this morning that's also really fucking dark.
Is it a sequel to this, or is it a sequel to the Twilight Zone
episode? Twilight Zone episode. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a sequel to the Twilight Zone episode. Has the same actor. He's got the same fucking face. It looks... Him as an older man is still creepy. It's still very... And he has a daughter. Mm. So he has a daughter that is just a normal human being, but he can't read her thoughts like he can read everybody else's thoughts. And later on, it gets revealed that she can do some of the things he does, and that she's actually more powerful because he can send people away. He can't bring anybody back.
Mm.
She can bring people back. So it's this whole like, and he still acts like he does as this fucking kid. He's just a little older. He's just like, and everybody is talking against me and they're keeping secrets and I don't like that. He's in the first
That's
scene.
Creepy.
Yeah. In the first scene, one of the kids accidentally pushes her off a tree and then the dad comes in to pick him up and he's just like what kind of kid would push a little girl off a tree? He's like, I don't know, Anthony. I think it's good that you're asking questions. And then like he literally makes him spontaneously combust in front of his kid.
Oh my god.
And then Anthony's like, well, you should go home to your mother because she's probably waiting for you. Like, it's fucking crazy. I highly recommend you find the sequel to that.
Yeah, I'll look into it.
But yeah, that concept of the story, I mm-hmm. think it's a really, really cool concept. But interesting question here. If you had Anthony's power, do you think he'd be good or evil?
I think I have too much empathy to be evil, and I think, I don't know. Because, like, I was thinking about that, too, as I was watching it, and I was just like, that would be a really cool power to have. But also, like, all children are sociopaths, so mm-hmm. I just, I don't know. Because, like, imagine, like, a 5-year-old temper tantrum and having this power, like, what that would look like.
Oh, I know.
You know?
Or fucking Anthony in middle school.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
The hormones are raging.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he does get a daughter later on.
Right.
It says that he banished his wife. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yep. Pretty fucked up.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
would you be evil?
I would be good, but I know, like, I would also get bored. So I don't know what would happen when I'm bored. But I would definitely be good because, again, I do have a lot of empathy for people. You know me, I'd rather see people thrive than people, like, be crushed kind of deal.
Yeah, or, you know, set on fire.
Yeah, or set on fire, whatever it is, you know?
But no, I think it's an interesting concept, but I think it just, there was a lot about this episode that freaked me out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just, like, the whole family, and it's just like, oh, no.
Sister with no mouth.
Yeah.
Oh, Sister with No Mouth.
That freaked me out, because mm-hmm. that's, like, also, that's a body horror thing that really always gets me, where it's just, like, where, like, parts of the body is, like, visibly not there, so, like, no mouth at all. Like, I'm just like, oh. Like, it freaked me out, even in that shitty, X-Men Origins Wolverine movie, mm-hmm. when, like, Deadpool had no mouth.
Yeah.
Like, and, like, even that, I was just like, oh.
Because in my mind, I'm like, but your mouth helps you breathe.
Yeah.
What's happening there? Where'd you get a stuffy nose? Come on, man.
Or like, and when it panned up and you could see that she had no face and her eyes were just like wide open, just like, you know, that freaked me out. That was like kind of like the grotesqueness that always gets me.
Dude, Joe Dante has some fucking style, I gotta say. Like, he did this one really well.
I loved the special effects. I loved the set.
Mm-hmm.
That really, I was just like, oh wow. So,
and then everybody placating him, like, it's a good thing. Like, yeah, we're good. Yeah, yeah, whatever you want.
Whatever you want. Yeah, that was, I was just like, oh God. Because, like, that's part of the reason that I kind of almost, like, felt bad for him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the whole time he was just like, it wasn't. Like, there were parts of him that were obviously, like, fucked up and evil, but also, like, when he befriended this chick, it was just, like, it seemed like he genuinely wanted a connection with someone that wasn't, like, always playing to his whims.
Mm-hmm. Like, he wanted a real person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But everyone was so scared of him that they kind of just did what he wanted.
Yeah. He's definitely coming to the point, I feel like, his way young adolescence, if you make him mad, he's gonna do the worst fucking thing.
Yeah.
But he's starting to come into consciousness now. And understand nuance.
Right.
But people still treat him like he can go off because they will be suffering things that are fucking terrifying, and they, no matter what, don't want to experience that.
Yeah. The dad in this, I texted you. He looked really familiar.
Who was he?
I don't know. Like, that's why I'm asking you.
I can't.
Let me pull it up really quick.
Oh, real quick though.
Yeah.
You know how this was done in The Simpsons, right? The voice of Bart Simpson, Nancy Cartwright, is actually in this episode, in this segment. She's one of the daughters.
Oh.
Yeah, so there's a connection that stayed through until the fucking 90s, son, when the story was, of course, done again. And then it was done with the sequel in the 2000s. So, yeah, this is a pretty, like, big story.
Yeah. So.
Did you find him? Did you find him?
I'm thinking of Kevin McCarthy.
What the fuck was he in?
He was in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He was in The Misfits. He was in The Howling. Let me see what else he was in.
Because
Yeah. What, like, of this century? Yeah. Let me see. He was in Looney Tunes Back in Action.
Never seen that one. I was a Space Jam person. You know?
Oh my God, it's going back in time. I need to go ahead in time. He was in something else that I've seen, and I know. Adam's Family Reunion.
Okay. Yep. Love that one. That was a good movie for my childhood too.
Wow, he was in Piranha.
Huh. James Cameron's first fucking movie.
Dark Tower.
I never seen Dark Tower.
That's so weird. I feel like there's something else here that I'm like, oh yeah, totally this guy, but it's nothing. I just feel like I've seen him before.
Yeah,
so.
No, you probably have. He was probably in Criminal Minds at one point.
Okay, fuck off.
We gotta mention it. It's been like an episode since we mentioned
it.
You
know? I did not mention it last episode, so...
That's funny.
Yeah, right. No.
But what are your thoughts now on, obviously, one of the most iconic stories of the whole series?
Mm-hmm.
Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. What'd you think of this particular take on that tale?
I enjoyed it. I found the creature from the original more scary than than this one.
How so? What made it more scary?
I don't know. It was just, like, this one was trying too hard to be scary.
Nah, I can attest.
Like, there was a little bit, like, too much effort behind, like, what is the creepiest fucking thing we can do to this guy? Mm-hmm. Or do to this, like, creature? And then in the other one, it was just, like, a grotesque creature.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, it wasn't, like, it was to the point, it was consistent, it had the grotesque facial features that would be upsetting to people, but it also wasn't trying super hard.
Like, it wasn't reptilian.
Yeah, this one was like a lot more reptilian, I found. But
I actually like the reptilian angle on it. No, I like the reptilian style of it, although it did seem a little...
Gratuitous?
A little gratuitous, actually, yeah, I'll say that. But the way it was shot actually reminded me a lot of Mad Max. Like,
yeah, well, I mean,
it's the same guy, but yeah, even like when he sees the creature in the window and pulls back in one shot and everybody's holding him,
yeah.
I was like, that's a fucking Mad Max
shot. I agree. That's actually
on his fucking head,
the exact shot that I was gonna talk about, like that camera angle,
yes, And then fucking John Lithgow, dude. I liked him way more than Shatner in this one.
He
way more.
He killed it. Yeah, William, yeah, Shatner did a good job. But
he did a fantastic job. He did an amazing job.
Yeah.
He did.
But I did enjoy Lithgow's performance a little bit more.
Well, he's like that neurotic, like, he's giving him stats on flying, and he doesn't have a wife, like, in the other one, so he has nobody there to support him. He's straight up just like, that thing that I've been warning about, this is even worse. Help me. Guys, fucking
like, what's
creature.
Going on? Yeah. And like
sweating.
Yeah, the,
and, like,
the sweating was profuse. Like, he was visibly terrified. You could see his, like, disgusted, horrified face in the window looking out onto the wing of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
This episode, like the original with William Shatner, had a lasting effect on me to this day, that if I'm flying at night, my thing is down.
Yeah.
I will never fly on the wing of a plane.
Oh, interesting.
To this day, I won't do it. I'm like, I'm not gonna risk it, because I also am just like, I am anxious by nature.
Yeah.
So like, and I know, like, logically I know that it's not real, and I know it would never actually happen.
But if you saw a spark on an engine, oh my god, what that would
it'd
do.
Be game fucking over.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. So this has a legacy that, like, you know, traumatized many a child, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. No, this had to... That effect that you felt, I imagine a lot of people have come across that same sensation because of this fucking series.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally. Because this episode was also my brother's favorite episode.
Oh, yeah.
So we watched it a lot.
Oh, and the Simpsons version with the school bus is actually really fucking good, too. Oh,
okay, I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah. Bart... is in the John. He acts more like John Lithgow than he William Shatner. But it's on the school bus, and a creature which looks, it's like a small version of this, but with hair and stuff. It's weird. Has a long nasty nail and starts pulling off the little things from the tire, like it's gonna come off. Yeah, it's actually really good. It's a really good take on this tale. It's
terrifying.
Yeah, I love it. But I love Treehouse of Horror like a motherfucker.
Yeah, you just love The Simpsons.
I do. But no, this honestly, to me, it's again one of the most iconic stories that comes from, like, American fiction because it's very contemporary, but it's still almost legendary.
Yeah,
like it's like an urban legend style thing. Like if a thousand years, this story would be in some text somewhere,
right?
Like as a fairy tale they told to their kids.
As lore.
As total fucking lore. John Lithgow just killed it in this thing, and it was shot so darkly that I just felt it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really felt every little nervous tick that he was feeling.
Yeah, I love the characterization they gave to the stewardess.
Mm-hmm.
The who was just, like, with him and was just, like, he's not insane. He, like, you know, like, she kind of believes him from the beginning.
Yeah.
Or at least believes that he believes that he's, you know, seeing something.
She's looking to take care of him.
Yeah. I appreciated that. I really liked her character. I love John Lithgow's character. I liked that from the very beginning. He's having a panic attack in the bathroom.
Yes. Oh, which is so apt.
Yeah, no, it's super apt, and I think it does a really good job of setting the scene, or, you know, for the thing. That little kid annoyed the shit out of me, though.
Oh, yeah.
The little girl.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just like, shut the fuck up.
But you know what? A lot of little kids on airplanes annoy the fuck out of me. So, you know, I feel it again. I think it's a very grounded version of this scenario.
It's realistic, no doubt.
Now, what would you do in the scenario, though? What would you do, Miss Alex Webster, on a plane, and then a creature that's not gratuitous, that's exactly what you fear, chilling there, just peeling off of that engine and looking in your eyes, and then when you try to tell somebody...
I wouldn't tell anyone.
But, like, you know, as soon as you turn, and somebody goes towards your window, he's, like, gone. What would you do?
I'd call my psychiatrist.
That's a good... I like that angle. You're like, because this is not real, okay?
Yeah, it's no, I think... I don't know, because, like, the only person I would probably be flying with would be DJ, and I'm not going to tell DJ that shit, because then, DJ would just be like...
Oh, cool. What is it?
Yeah, exactly. Fucking exactly. Like...
Oh, totally.
But what about you?
I would believe I'm going crazy.
Yeah?
There'd be no... I'd be like, fuck... I don't
this
know.
Is it.
Like,
I'm finally losing my mind.
How am I going to convince somebody of this? I'd be like, well, I'd probably do the same thing. Like, someone else has to see this, right? But the scenario is that no one else does, and it leaves when they do. So I would just lose my fucking mind. I'd be in the restroom a lot.
I think it would be one of those things where, especially in today's age, like, just, like, sneak up the iPhone and just be like, click.
Yep.
And no, then be true. Like, look at this shit.
You're like, could you, like, oh, this is a shadow. Fuck you, that's a shadow.
Well, here, and here's the thing, is I would probably actually never know that it was happening, because not only do I have a fear of flying, mm-hmm. I have a fear of storms.
Oh, yes.
So.
To combine them,
so
fuck
to combine them, my thing would just be down the whole time, and I'd probably, to be perfectly honest with you, I would probably be knocked out because I took too many Xanax. Like, that is, realistically, that is probably what happened. I would be, like, completely off my rocker, like, knocked out, like, drooling onto a pillow, just, like, knocked out listening to, like, a podcast or something.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, your window cover's actually broken, so I'm sorry, ma'am. It's gonna be open this whole time, and your Xanaxes are old, expired, so all you're doing is hallucinating now?
Yeah, because then that's what I would do.
Scenario
that is see, that is the modern retelling where yes. someone takes expired like Ambien or something
yeah. and they're like, the thing's, it won't shut down. Oh yeah, that one's broken, we're sorry about the inconvenience.
Okay, then I'd switch spots and I'd be like, good night.
Yeah. but no the Xanax is working on DJ's in that moment. all the cards are in place.
Yeah, see, you just keep like twisting my words so that it becomes fucked up, and I'm just like, I'm trying to solve the Xanax. Yeah. I'm trying to make it so I don't go crazy.
Every little bit just works against you. Oh, that's hilarious.
Anthony wants me to go crazy.
Just in one flight.
Just one.
Just in one flight. Okay, but in this last question here, actually, if there were the sequels that had gone as planned, mm-hmm. if this had actually been the franchise and the success that they hoped it would be, no yeah. accident, none of that stuff, and each sequel had 4 segments, in the next sequel, Twilight Zone, the movie 2, what 4 segments would you like to actually see in that movie?
Out of Time.
Out of Time, fuck yeah.
Monsters.
Nick of Time, yes.
Monsters on Maple Street.
Okay, that's, yeah, that would be a good
Living
a good
Doll.
Living Doll, fuck yeah. Living Doll would be the shit.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think about the ones that, like, traumatized me the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other one, the girl who gets surgery on her face.
Yeah, the masks.
Yes.
No, not the masks.
No, the one who has surgery on her face, mm-hmm. and she
Eye
wakes
up. Eye of the
up.
Beholder.
Yes, it's just Eye of the Beholder. Yes, so fuck, those would yeah. be ones that, especially, I would love to see a retelling of Eye of the Beholder, especially in today's society with, like, plastic surgery culture and yes. everything. And like, I would love to see that.
Contemporary special effects, mm-hmm. that would act, oh. Oh, fuck yeah. That's a really good one.
Thank you.
I think, yeah, no, good, solid choices. Okay. Okay, so Monsters Do on Maple Street would be apt, of course, because of the nuclear
yeah.
fucking fears. And then Nick of Time, obviously. That one fucks everybody up. I mean, it's just one of those scenarios. Anybody that has glasses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Knows about that shit.
Yeah.
And then what was the third one?
For me?
Yes.
Living Doll.
Oh, fuck yeah. Okay, Living Doll, we've talked about that and even the last mm-hmm. one. But a modern retelling would be pretty goddamn cool.
That'd it would be cool, especially if it was, like, a creepy, like, it was, like, a grandma's, like, Victorian doll. The grandma dies, the mm-hmm. girl, like, inherits this talking doll. I know that the talking doll trope has kind of been tired for mm-hmm. a while because of the Child's Play series.
Yeah, I mean, how it's evolved since,
yeah. and how it's evolved, but I would love for a classic retelling to go back to the roots
mm-hmm.
of a creepy, like, Victorian or whatever, like, glass doll.
That would be cool.
That
I dig it. I dig it.
And okay. it talks only to this shitty, like, in this case, it'd probably be, like, an abusive father.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, you could definitely do more with the what happened to the Living Doll. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, that was the 60s benign version. Like,
yeah.
A modern retelling would be...
Intense.
Intense. Absolutely intense. Okay, cool. Good, solid 4 choices, actually.
Thank you. Yeah,
I have the Beholder, though, I think I'd be most excited about.
Yeah, you think?
Because there's so much they can do, especially with the way people nowadays
yeah.
are just so, like, me, fucking blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah.
that would be, like, the whole world is fucked up.
Yeah.
And you're, the only reason you look blotchy or whatever is because you're a human. Like, it's just cool. It's
yeah.
fucking cool.
What
okay.
about you?
I would actually do Eye of the Beholder.
Yeah.
I would totally put that one on there. I had 2 other ones that I really, really thought, but then you threw me off right now because oh. your selection was awesome.
Oh, thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. There's one that's called Dust.
It's the Western one, right?
It's the Western one. And the story of this one is a man is put in jail and sentenced to be executed because his wagon ran over a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the day of her funeral. And after the funeral, he is to be executed. And his dad is trying to get him out. And the town itself is bloodthirsty
mm-hmm.
because he killed someone by being drunk. And
drunk driving.
Drunk driving. But it's such a really layered Twilight Zone episode because the parents of the girl,
mm-hmm.
like, don't want... Like, they're conflicted about it. They're basically being pressured from the town.
Yeah.
And the town's poor. The town has no water. Like, it's seriously, like, a town in the south that, like, had no business for fucking 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, dying. So it's really cool because it's an anti-twist episode.
Oh, okay.
You think there's going to be a kind of twist, but the twist isn't cosmic or anything like that. It's with the people.
Mm.
So it's a good episode on mob mentality. I would also do 5 characters in search of an exit. Have you heard of that one?
No, because you know all the episode names. I'm just like, the one where this happens, because I watched them so long ago when I was so young. I don't remember episode names. I'm just like, the one where this happened. Because I have one that I do want to bring up.
Mm-hmm. In a second. We'll do it. Yeah. In Dust, though, you might remember it because, spoiler alert, guys. When they go to hang him,
mm-hmm.
and some guy gives him his dad, who's trying to save him, a magic bean or magic dust that he pulls from the fucking ground and says, if you just spray it around... everybody's hate will turn to love and your son will be saved. And then he goes to throw the dust at everybody and everybody's just laughing at the dad as his son has the noose around his neck. And they're just like, they're seriously pointing in like, and he's just like, believe in the magic, please, please. Like, it's sad. And they pull the lever and hang his son, but the rope breaks and the whole town's just silent. And they're like, put him up again. And the parents are like, we've already seen one death today. Like, we've already had to bury one person today. Like, let's move past this. And it's such a weird tale. Like, it's one of the weirdest episodes I've seen.
Isn't this the one where, like, the guy who sells him the dust is, like, some weird, like, hokey, like, used, like, oil,
yeah.
like,
he's snake like a snake oil guy, and he's fucking evil. Yeah.
Okay, I kind of remember this. I don't remember that ending.
Mm-hmm.
But
It's happy.
Yeah, the one that I'm thinking of is the guy who's miserable. He's going to commit suicide. He makes a deal with the devil.
Yes.
Like, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Where he can live forever,
mm-hmm.
but he has, like, a get-out-of-jail-free card where if he's ever in a situation, he will, like, die quick and painlessly, basically. Mm-hmm. And he goes to this, like, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, no.
Yeah. So I remember that one, and I remember that one, like, freaking me out, because, like, I've always, like, kind of, like, fantasized, like, what if I could live forever? What mm-hmm. would I do? And then being stuck in a situation, like, being buried alive,
yeah.
or being stuck on an island, like that fate worse than death type yeah. of thing. Like, that is, like, those kinds of things always freak me out, because I'm like, what if I could live forever,
mm-hmm.
but I was, like...
Chopped up,
stuck in, like... a cage or stuck like in a coffin mm-hmm. or that kind of shit where I'm just like
yeah no that's true. That's also a good one too. I would say that. I would also do, again, the 5 character search of exit. It's the one that has the tambourine man, I believe,
mm-hmm.
army, the clown, the ballerina dancer, and they're all stuck in this room that only has a ceiling, and they have to try to they want to get out, but nobody knows why they're there or what's been happening, and it turns out that each of these characters are actually dolls.
Oh, I remember that one.
I would do that one as one of
them. Oh, that would be good.
That would be a very heavy dialogue-driven episode,
well,
but that would be fucking awesome.
That one would be hard because if you've seen the episode, you know the ending. Because mm-hmm. I feel like what was so effective about that episode is that it's like one of those things that you can watch it once.
Because mm-hmm.
like any other time, you're just like, I understand the context of this now, and it makes a lot more sense. But the first time you watch it, and you watch it all the way through, and you get to the ending, and you learn they're all dolls, you're just like, mm-hmm. oh, fuck. I've been fooled.
Yeah. I would also do The Invaders, which is this girl, is this woman, she's like very kind of, she doesn't talk a lot. It's with no dialogue, almost no dialogue. And these little tiny space flying saucers are coming at her and shooting her and like trying to kill her, basically, but they're basically the size of Legos, and she's swatting them away, whatever it is. And then it reveals later on that it's actually the NASA, and that she actually is a giant on a planet that they don't, that doesn't they've never been to. Yeah, that's a good one. Have you seen that?
I think Maybe. I feel like I've heard of that one at least. Again, I need to do a rewatch so bad. I have not seen. But it's also, like, I have the same issue with Twilight Zone, the same issue I have with Black Mirror. I have to be in... I love them. I fucking adore them. But I have to be in such a particular, like, mood and headspace to want to watch them.
Yes.
That I'm just like...
Because they can destroy you a little bit.
Well, right, and they can just be, like, mentally, like, you know, like, the mind fuck type stuff always kind of can make me feel really, really, like, they can spike my anxiety really, really badly. So
to me, it's like spicy food. I have to test it. I have to test it.
So, like, I'll love watching them. I still haven't watched The Black Museum.
Which one?
The last episode of Black Mirror for this last season. I know.
Such a good episode.
I put it off for so long that I forgot that I hadn't seen it. Mm-hmm. And then the new Black Mirror, the movie.
Yeah.
Bandersnatch. Yeah, Bandersnatch. I watched that and it makes, like, there's like two references.
To that?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen it yet.
So. Yeah. Well, when we're recording this, hopefully by the time it comes out, you will have seen it.
Yeah.
But when I was watching it, I was just like, I still need to watch The Black Museum.
it's one of the best ones of that season.
Yeah, though, I know. So it's really good. I know, you keep saying that.
The last one, though, I would either do The Hitchhiker or The After Hours. I'm not sure. Hitchhiker's pretty easy. Do you remember that one? She's hitchhiking and she keeps seeing some man chasing her or at every stop. And it's the same fucking guy. And it turns out it's actually Death. And she had died a long time ago. And she was like,
yes.
So she brings him on, and it's like, now we're going to go to the afterlife.
Yeah.
And then The After Hours, the one with the mannequins.
Yeah.
It's a tough choice between those two.
Well, you gave a lot of really good options, too.
Thank you. After Hours is such a sentimental ending, though. I feel like with Dust, I had to choose between Dust or The After Hours, because they both have very sentimental endings.
Yeah.
That's not the usual, like...
The typical.
Fucked up.
Yeah.
So you can only have one of those. Uh-huh. This would be the kick the can area.
Yeah, the kick the can slot.
Yeah, slot number two. Yeah, that's true. All right, well, other than that, do you think it's a good time? A good place
as any to wrap it up. Thank you so much for joining us for this incredibly emotionally traumatizing episode of the Horrible People's Podcast.
Yeah, you know, you gotta learn about this stuff sometime, guys, because this did change the industry, of course, and even the Twilight Zone itself is prone to reality to just fucking everything up.
So thank you for joining us. This has been the Twilight Zone the movie, directed by John Landis, Steven Spielberg, Joe Dante, and George Miller. So if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. It means the world to us. We've already gotten some really nice reviews, and it always makes me happy. I read them when I'm sad. Also, if you did enjoy this episode, or if you've enjoyed any of our past episodes, tell someone about it, because, you know, we can only do so much.
Yes.
But no, please tell a friend about us. If, you know, something that I've heard is if you have a friend who likes film and likes film theory, but might not necessarily be a huge horror fan, they might actually really like this podcast, because a bunch of my friends hate horror films, but they love this podcast because it lets them digest what's going on in the horror films.
Yeah, without having to actually be scared.
Without actually having to be terrified.
That makes sense.
So I'm happy that we get to be your guides through that.
I'm happy to provide that fucking service. Hell
yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. So yeah, those are some ways that you can support us. If you're so inclined, please follow us on Instagram. You can find us on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORRORBLE People's Podcast.
Woohoo.
You can also find us on Twitter at Horror People Pod.
Much easier to spell.
Yes. We did just create a Facebook page. If you're so inclined, like us, you can search at Horror People Pod on Facebook to find us there. Mm-hmm. We're not going to use it a whole lot. We're just kind of having it there for propriety's sake. But please feel free.
Yeah.
Any support is support. So I appreciate it. And I appreciate all of you guys for listening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And then next week, we're doing found footage.
Yes, we are taking another dive, thankfully, into found footage. It is not as fucked up as the Poughkeepsie tapes,
no.
I promise.
And I haven't seen this one, actually.
I love this movie. I haven't seen it in a while, so I'm not sure how much I remember it being like that great, but I did enjoy it. It's a good film. I would say it's an enjoyable film, and there's a lot to break down. I haven't like done a whole lot with it yet, but I'm excited.
Oh, I'm so down. Because I love found footage. I love found footage.
So I love found footage too, as everyone knows. I kicked us off with a really, really gnarly one.
Yes, but you know what? The right one, honestly.
Yeah, so.
And it's not one that's like as known. It's not one of the fucking paranormals or whatever it is. Like
that. I almost said the name of the movie we're watching next week. Yeah. I was like, yeah, not like blank, 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 blank. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is going to be another one of those, not necessarily underground. It's known, but it's just not.
It's known. It didn't have a surge in popularity like other found footage films. So it's not a super popular film. So that cuts out. You know, Blair Witch, that cuts out Paranormal Activity. So we're not definitely not covering those.
But we will at some point.
Don't worry,
guys.
We'll get there. It'll be good.
Those have fucking awesome histories. That, oh, can't wait. But this will be interesting, guys.
So it'll be a good time. So like I said, thank you everyone for joining us, and we'll catch you next week.
Yep. Peace out, you fucks.
Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.